Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Americans who want to travel abroad but avoid places that seem dangerous often book trips to Europe. A week in France or Germany or Greece seems to promise a novel experience with all the modern conveniences of home and without any real risks. But as any historian or European survivor of World War II could tell you, the era of peace and prosperity that seems to be a permanent condition is in fact an aberration in the long history of the continent. And as my guest will explain, the Europe of open borders and easy trade relations may be far less stable and secure than it has appeared since the middle of the 20th century. George Friedman is chairman and founder of the private intelligence company Stratfor and author of the new book Flashpoints, The Emerging Crisis in Europe. He's in town to speak this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. George, welcome back to Think.
I'm glad to be here again.
How did it happen that much of Europe enjoyed a few decades of peace and prosperity after the First and then after the Second World War? And how did that contrast with the rest of European history?
Well, after the First World War, they were just exhausted, and it only lasted 20 years.
Yeah.
After the Second World War, Europe was occupied. It was occupied by the Russians. It was occupied by the Americans. It didn't have its sovereignty. The decision on war and peace was made in Moscow and in Washington. And the Americans and the Russians were actually very careful. So there was peace. Europe has been both sovereign and at peace only since 1992. And even during that time, 100,000 people died in Yugoslavia and 40,000 people died in the Caucasus. So the illusion of Europe having been peaceful throughout its entire history, including the 20th century, is just not real. I mean, only if you don't count the Balkans as part of Europe, only if you don't count the Caucasus as part. But this has been one of the bloodiest areas of the world for a whole bunch of reasons.
To what extent did the Marshall Plan set Europe up for that period of sovereignty and prosperity that began, as you say, in 1992?
Well, the entire idea of European integration, which finally leads to the European Union, was an American idea. Part of the Marshall Plan was the idea of an integrated European economy. Otherwise, without that integration, the planners felt nothing could happen. The Europeans opposed it vehemently. The French wanted nothing to do with the Germans. The British wanted nothing to do with the French. No one really wanted to give up sovereignty or anything to each other. The reason it finally started was that Charles de Gaulle made a decision. Charles de Gaulle was the great French leader, and he decided to go along with European integration, leaving the British out, of course, because he felt that he could unite Europe under France, and then France could both become a global player again and Europe could balance the United States. It was a political calculation on his part, less than an economic calculation. But it wasn't the Europeans who came up with the idea of integration, and it wasn't the Europeans who insisted on it. It was the Americans.
Is there something about the structure of the EU that is inherently flawed and set the EU up for failure?
Well, the fundamental problem of the EU is the free trade zone, because at the center of Europe is Germany. Today, Germany exports the equivalent of 50% of its GDP. This is quite a rise from 1992 when the Maastricht Treaty, which created the EU, was signed. At that point, it was about 20% of a much smaller GDP. So Germany is absolutely dependent on its customers. One of the things we've discovered about efficient exporters is they're efficient to the point that their customers can buy. And Germany exports half of what it exports, so that's a quarter of its GDP, to the European Union. And the free trade zone of the European Union is absolutely essential to the Germans. Because the Germans are such efficient exporters, much of Southern Europe and Eastern Europe have been unable to develop. And what we had after the crisis of 2008 was a massive surge of unemployment. Greece now has 26% unemployed. Southern Italy has about 22% unemployed. Spain has about 23% unemployed. France, in certain areas, is equally unemployed. These are the same numbers the United States had during the Great Depression. And that's what's really important to understand. While Germany has 5% unemployed and Austria has 5% unemployed, Southern Europe is in depression. Eastern Europe is obsessed with the Russians and feels it has no backing from the rest of the Europeans. So you're in a very strange situation where the European Union consists of at least three different parts, each experiencing being different European very differently.
If things were not this good for the German export economy in the early 90s, why was it positioned to end up in such a better position, in such a better place than places like Italy and Greece?
Well, for one thing, the rules that were created in Europe favored the preservation of 1950s-style corporations. It's very difficult to be entrepreneurial in Europe. The tax rates are so high as you go up that you really can't make money as an entrepreneur. If you get lucky, they'll take it away. And the various rules on bankruptcy and the various rules on hiring people are such that if you do take the risk of being an entrepreneur and you fail, as I like to say, you haven't hired a person, you've adopted him. So entrepreneurial behavior really hasn't surged. There is no Google coming up. There is no Microsoft. There is no Apple. Facebooks don't come up. The 1950s-style corporation.
Where you make stuff.
Where you make stuff, but also where you get a job and you keep your job there. That's the German welfare program. So the German welfare program is you get a job at Siemens and you stay at Siemens. And one of the ways that Germany does that is protecting Siemens, making certain that a Romanian or an Italian entrepreneur doesn't come up with a Apple or a Microsoft, and they don't. So Germany had a dominant political position, and they could shape the regulations of Europe in such a way that it guaranteed access to markets that were hungry for goods. And to the extent those goods were made in these countries, Germany owned the factories.
You suggest that history should make us wary of a Germany that is powerful, dynamic, and insecure, three conditions that you say exist right now. Why is today's Germany so economically powerful but so geopolitically insecure?
Well, firstly, where it is on the North German European plain, flat, empty. But more than that, Germany has a terrible history. It knows it has a terrible history. It doesn't want to repeat that history. On the one hand, it is enormously economically powerful, shaping other countries. This inevitably makes it resented. And anti-German feeling in Europe at this point is really startling, as just as German contempt for the rest of Europe is startling. At the same time, it doesn't want to take any military action. That is the farthest thing from its mind. So at the same time that it is exporting 50% of its GDP, it is the single most vulnerable country in Europe. Because when you export that much, you're hostage to your customers. And the terror of the Germans is that the rest of the Europeans will go protectionist or use other means to stop exporting. The problem the Germans has, they can't grow more exports. You can't export more than they're exporting. The only way they have is down. If it goes down, then they get unemployment, then they get social stability, then they get all the things they don't want. The decision of whether or not their exports go down isn't theirs. It is the political decisions of other countries. Germany is terrified of trying to influence those political decisions because that goes back to the old days that they don't want to repeat. And so it's trapped between the past that it doesn't want to repeat and the present that's far more insecure than it looks to most people.
You mentioned that one of the factors in the particular state of Germany right now is where Germany is located. This book really drove home for me the fact that like the topography and the geography of Europe has a lot to do with how it has formed in modern history to no less extent than the United States.
geography is critical for any country. In the case of Germany, it rests on something called the North European Plain that stretches from the Atlantic north of the Alps all the way into Russia and forms Russia. When you live in a Northern European Plain, you can't really defend yourself very well with natural barriers, and so your borders are always shifting. Until 1871, Germany didn't exist. It was a series of dozens of fragmented small principalities, and it was always being pulled apart by Russia and by France, which had united earlier. And so German history on the North European Plain has been a history of insecurity. They've never quite been at ease, and they've really only been a country since 1871 in the modern sense, and have done extraordinarily well and extraordinarily badly all at the same time.
How would you characterize the relationship today between Germany and Russia?
Germany and Russia have always had a complex relationship. They've had alliances. The Russians were pivotal in the creation of modern Germany. They've also fought terrible genocidal wars with each other. At the moment, Germany is looking at the United States, which it really doesn't trust. It looks at the rest of Europe, and it can't quite get a handle on what's going on. It desperately needs markets to export to. The Russians have suddenly become much poorer than they were because of oil prices. But the Germans look to Russia as an alternative, not a full solution to their problem, but a partial solution, something to mitigate what happens elsewhere. The last thing they want is a conflict with Russia. They've had too many. The Cold War was about a conflict with Russia, and they were caught in the middle. Second World War. They don't want a conflict with Russia. They look at the United States becoming much more aggressive toward Russia. They're extremely uneasy about that. They look at their Eastern European neighbors, particularly Poland, and they worry about that. So Germany is a country filled with anxiety.
Can you talk about the identity issues that Russia has? Clearly you can look at a map and see that it straddles Asia and Europe. And there it seems to be difficult for Russia to put its finger on exactly who it is, what it is.
It is that part of Europe which is not the European peninsula. Most of the rest of Europe, of the peninsula itself, is 300 miles from the sea. Wherever you are, either the North Sea, the Baltic Sea, the Atlantic, the Mediterranean, something is close enough to you that it can influence your life. Russia is that part which is landmass. There's the Arctic way to the north. There's the Indian Ocean beyond the Himalayas. But really, this is a landmass. So this differs fundamentally from the other parts of Europe in that it's land-based. Its internal transportation is poor. Its ability to move food from the growing regions to the cities has always been difficult. It's been difficult to govern. What's held Russia together, really, through the Russian Empire, was the secret police, the Okhraina in the old days, the Cheka, the NKVD, the KGB, now the FSB. That has been the glue that has held it together. Sometimes the Orthodox Church, which has been a unifying principle, but it's really been that both the Tsars and Stalin and Putin rely on the secret police. If they become inefficient, Russia's glue falls apart.
We're speaking this hour with George Friedman. He is chairman and founder of the private intelligence company Stratfor and author of the new book, Flashpoints, The Emerging Crisis in Europe. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning. With classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with George Friedman, who is chairman and founder of the private intelligence company Stratfor and author of the new book Flashpoints, The Emerging Crisis in Europe. He's in town to speak this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. George, can the EU be stabilized at this point, and should it be? Is it worth saving?
Well, it consists of so many different parts.
Yeah.
The question is what? Here's the fundamental question for the Greeks and also for the Irish, who have just also announced that they want to renegotiate their debt, and the others will too. Is it better to go bankrupt, to not pay the debts, or is it better to pay? From a political point of view, it's almost impossible to get these countries to pay the debt in the sense that the pressure that it's putting on the population is just overwhelming. You have to remember who lost their jobs in this. We say the governments cut back, and these were government employees. And in America, government employees seem to be kind of marginal people. But in countries like Greece, where the medical system is part of the government, where the electric company is owned by the government, where it goes on, these are doctors, lawyers, electronic engineers. These are the middle class, the professional class. And those that didn't lose their jobs, and we have a friend in Greece who used to make 3,000 euros a month, had his salary cut to $800,
wow.
800 euros a month. So the numbers hide how bad it is. These are people who, when they lost their jobs, figured in a year or two they'd get them back. So say they were 55 7 years ago. They're 52 now. And they're realizing, one, that their children, college graduates, aren't getting jobs. They don't have jobs. They've lost their houses. They've lost their credit. They've lost all the things that made them professionals, everything they expected their lives to be about. When the poor lose even more, okay, it is not a psychological blow. It's a tragedy, but not a psychological blow. When the middle class, the professional class, loses everything they had and loses all hope of regaining it, this is where extreme psychological reactions take place. And this is where extreme political parties are born. And Europe, unlike 7 years ago, is now filled with extreme political parties. In Spain, for example, there's one party that wants an independent Catalonia, which is where Barcelona, the biggest city, is. There's another party, Podemos, which is a left-wing party that wants Spain, if not to default, to completely renegotiate. In France, and this has been there for a while, there's the National Front, which is, frankly, a right-wing racist party with their focus on multiple ethnic groups, but also very popular because it's protecting the interests of the middle class and the working class in ways that the other parties don't. So you've had a tremendous delegitimization of the mainstream parties, and you've had a rise of extremist parties, some on the right extremely racist, some on the left merely Marxist or at least anti-European. It's hard to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And the more that the Germans insist on austerity, the more that this class has no hope of regaining its power. Well, these are people who know how to organize. These are people who know, who have worked in large entities and know how to build political organizations, and they're building them. The contradiction between Germany as this massive exporter should be thought of this way. If the United States made half of its gross domestic product by exporting half of it to Canada and Mexico, what would the condition of Canada and Mexico be, and how long would they allow it? So the problem that you have here is that there was a fundamental flaw in the thinking about the European Union. It was the idea that although Germany was utterly dependent on exports, these other countries could develop as well. And after 2008, that became impossible.
Have the economic challenges in so many parts of Europe slowed immigration from other parts of the world, and particularly the Middle East and Muslim countries?
Well, remember, parts of the Middle East are in chaos.
Yeah.
But certainly immigration has slowed. But during the good years, they permitted massive immigration without integration. So what they called, you know, very liberally multiculturalism really meant, on the part of many of these countries, that we don't want you part of our culture. You can stay here. You can be a citizen. You can't be a German, a Dane, an Italian, or something like that.
Even two generations in or something, these individuals are still not accepted.
Well, the United States is an artificial country. We built it out of many layers of migration. And we know how to integrate the migrants while allowing them to keep their Irish or Jewish or whatever identity. The European nation is a natural nation. It is built on history, culture, religion, language. The idea of becoming French when you weren't born in France is not impossible, but it's very difficult to think of it that way, while it's very easy to think of it in the American context. And so they have had tremendous difficulty conceptualizing the Islamic migration as part of their own culture. And their solution has been to wall them off in multiculturalism, on the one side pretending that this is a respect for your difference, on the other side saying you're never going to be part of us. And that has led to all sorts of tension independent of Islamic terrorism.
It would seem as if the secularization of Europe in the latter half of the 20th century would have made it less likely that there would be this marginalization of the Muslim population there.
Well, the problem of secularization is that you accept that the church has no standing, but you still haven't solved the problem of what does it mean to be French, or what does it mean to be Hungarian, or what does it mean to be Polish? What holds the nation together? Because you also have under secularization the idea of national self-determination. Well, if there's a national self-determination, it has to be a nation. And so they wound up thinking about the nation in what I call romantic terms. The Germans have these grim fairy tales that are usually about stepmothers, coming and kidnapping children and trying to kill them. They're pretty horrible when you read them.
Especially if you're a stepmother, let me tell you.
they're pretty horrible, but they touched on the poor woodcutter who lived in the forest, and they made him a hero. His children liberated him. And think of Hansel and Gretel, of course. The various folk cultures were elevated at the same time secularism was. God was gone, and all the limiters of Christianity and everything were gone. The myth of the nation was elevated. And the secular concept that, well, whatever it is that you do, it is quite acceptable so long as it's authentically you. And it created not just now, but going back into the 19th century, a unstable condition that really had trouble adjusting without going overboard. And part of fascism grew out of that, because fascism was simultaneously secular in the sense that it was really atheistic. It was also mythical. It was also national. And by the time you got done, what was the limit?
Did the when you look at, and I'm asking you to generalize here, and I recognize that, but say Muslim immigrants to a place like France, by and large, they arrived because they wanted jobs, not because they thought France has the greatest culture and we want to be part of that. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, the reason they came there was the Turks and Algerians is the opportunities in their country are minimal. There was a chance to make money, and the intention was to go home. Like many immigrants, they stay, and their children stay, and so on. So it was the French didn't want them to come there to be French. They didn't go there to be French. They went there to make money. And particularly in this economic crisis, which is a serious proportions. The Muslims appear to be intruders. And overlay on that what's happening in the Islamic world and the rise of things like the Islamic State, I mean, you have a powder keg.
Where do the parallels start and end between anti-Muslim sentiment in Europe right now and the long history on the continent of anti-Semitism?
They're very similar. I was in a museum in Trier, Germany, and it was very interesting. They had many things about Germany and the town of Trier. And off in a corner was, next to each other, the Jewish exhibit and the Muslim exhibit. There is a parallel in the sense that as much as the Jews who immigrated from the East wanted to become part of that culture, particularly in Germany, and they did, it was never a perfect fit. And then when catastrophe hit and someone had to be blamed, the Jews were blamed. This isn't to say the Jews didn't have a role in it, and it doesn't mean to say that Muslims shouldn't be blamed. But there's a dynamic there that when you have imperfectly assimilated people and you have a culture that requires assimilation but won't allow it to take place, when something goes wrong, the outsider is blamed.
What would you say Russia wants? I mean, I guess Russia wants Ukraine, but what is Russia looking to do? Can you see their game plan clearly as you watch their actions over the past couple of years?
Russia has survived because it has buffers. It survived Hitler because of Ukraine. The Russian view of the world is that it's a dangerous place and you can't assume that it's going to stay benign. In 1932, Germany was liberal and a mess. By 1938, it was the Nazis, and it was the most powerful military force on the continent. So what they know is these things change very fast. And they also know that in a contest between the peninsula and Russia, Russia will always be weaker militarily. It defeated Napoleon because it had space. Since the early 18th century, Ukraine, Belarus, the Baltics were part of the Russian Empire, of the Soviet Union for the most part. Putin did not want Ukraine to be a part, you know, subsidiary part, an integral part of Russia. It did want to make certain that no foreign troops would be there, that no foreign integration would take place. It wanted a neutral area. The events in Kiev at the beginning of last year changed that. It created a pro-Western government, one that was heavily supported by the United States and the Europeans. The Russian view was that the United States has no reason to be this interested in Ukraine unless it didn't mean it meant the Russians harm. And they reacted ineffectively. Their intelligence forces failed to anticipate what happened in Kiev. The intelligence forces failed to do anything about it. They expected to have an uprising in eastern Ukraine that didn't happen. So Putin, who at least dominated Ukraine wholly, was left holding only Crimea and a part of eastern Russia, which was a massive defeat. After oil prices fell, he had a wreckage of a foreign policy and a wreckage of an economy simultaneously. So he suddenly found himself in a terrifically bad political situation. And if we look at the events of the past week with him disappearing and then reappearing, clearly there's some sort of power struggle going on in the Kremlin that's very hard to define. But what does he want? He wants the West to respect the basic buffer zones that have existed. The West has already allowed the Baltics to become part of NATO. That he can't do anything about. That happened under Yeltsin. That's gone. But he wants Ukraine to remain a buffer, a neutral buffer. He doesn't care what kind of government it has. The United States wants what it calls national self-determination for the Ukrainians, saying that the Russians have no business in it. The Russian answer is, well, then why did you get all excited about Cuba? And so it goes. But the fact of the matter is Ukraine is as important to Russia and its national security as Texas is to the United States.
What sort of influence and power does NATO have today?
Well, a military alliance exists if it has a military, and NATO barely has a military. In other words, the United States has a military. The British has a military that it's making even smaller. The French have a military of questionable capabilities because of poor equipment. And for the most part, the rest of Europe is demilitarized. So NATO is, as I like to put it, a wonderful place for career officers to go to have cocktail parties. But in terms of planning military operations, you have to remember that any one nation can veto anything the way it's structured. And that's one of the oddities of NATO. So the United States is mostly involved in creating bilateral relations with Poland, with the Baltics, with Romania outside the framework of NATO, because for one thing, Germany doesn't want to see any of these things happening. It wants to tamp down the crisis.
So leaving out Russia and Ukraine and the Baltic states, are the flashpoints in Europe likely to turn into military conflicts?
Well, in Ukraine, they already have.
Yeah. Well, I'm setting that aside for this moment.
And over time, I mean, the other flashpoint that's very important is the one between Turkey and the Balkans. Right now, we look at this as an Islamist issue, but Turkey is certainly reemerging. One of the luckiest things that ever happened to it was they wouldn't let it into the EU. And so it's, you know, been developing very nicely. Right now, it's not ready for any sort of involvement. But the Balkans are historically a place where it's been involved and interested. And that certainly is an area where many countries would be very uneasy seeing a large Baltic presence. You also have to remember that Turkey had substantial interests and occupied Crimea and other countries. The Tatars are Turks that live there.
Let me jump in for a second. We have to take a quick break. My guest is George Friedman, chairman and founder of Stratfor, author of the new book Flashpoints, The Emerging Crisis in Europe. You can join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning. With classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. SMU.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest George Friedman is in town to speak this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. He is chairman and founder of the private intelligence company Stratfor and author of a new book called Flashpoints, The Emerging Crisis in Europe. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. All right, you were talking before the break about Turkey. Please continue.
Turkey has been a Black Sea power. It has been very much involved in Ukraine. Turkey is a country that's deeply involved in the Caucasus, in Georgia and Azerbaijan and places like that. This is a real flashpoint. Turkey rising at the same time that Europe is in chaos, and the Islamic world is in a chaos. I mean, this is going to reshape the region. And there's a general flashpoint, of course, between the Mediterranean, between North Africa and Southern Europe. Right now, it manifests itself basically as migration. But we've already seen the Europeans, for example, initiate the attacks on Libya. You see the French deeply involved in what's going on in Algeria. So there are lots of flashpoints, but the most important flashpoints in Europe are those internal to countries. Remember, we just saw 45% of Scots voting for independence from Britain after three centuries. People are delighted that it lost. Stop and think, 45% wanted independence. In Spain, as I've said, Catalonia wants independence. the Belgians, the Walloons who are French and the Flemish who are Dutch, riot against each other and are talking about dividing the country and getting rid of it. The Hungarians in Transylvania want to leave Transylvania and rejoin Hungary. So the most important flashpoints are not only those traditional ones between Russia and the European peninsula, or Turkey. The most important ones are within these countries. And these countries have flashpoints not only geographically, but socially. I've never known a period. I've gone to Europe. I was born in Europe, and I've gone to Europe all my life, where the elite in Europe is more out of touch with the realities of everyday life. If you read the Financial Times, they're delighted that the banks are stable. They seem not to understand that they're sitting on a volcano of social instability. What's going to happen? I mean, what is going to happen when a quarter of your population who used to live well now live in misery? These are the kinds of flashpoints that Europe has, and that can form into new flashpoints. Conflicts between nations, between Romania and Hungary. Conflicts between Germany and some of its neighbors. It's unpredictable where these go, but certainly the number of flashpoints since 2008 have pyramided.
Hasn't nationalism in Europe, though, always been about something other than the sort of geopolitical borders and boundaries? There have always been these subcultures within European countries. What's different today?
Well, what happened was that after World War One, all of these multicultural empires collapsed, and all these small nations appeared. And the whole idea was that every nation had a right to its own nationhood, national self-determination. So they created Czechoslovakia, and then the Czechs and the Slovaks, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, decided to divorce. That was peaceful. It was called a velvet divorce. But Yugoslavia, which was also an invented nation of multicultural entities, divorced, and 100,000 people died.
Yeah.
So there's always been in Europe submerged entities in empires. There's also been wars constantly in Europe over the borders and things like that. And right now, with this basic principle that every nation has a right to a state, you've seen fragmentation after fragmentation. The latest massive one was the Soviet Empire, where Turkmenistan and Kyrgyzstan and places that hadn't been independent in a very long time now are nation states, and who knows what they'll do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Eric in Dallas. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
First, Chris, I want to say every time you get a comment from a guest that says it's a great question, I smile for you.
Thank you.
I think you might do as well. But my question is for the guest. Turkey is sort of on a precipice between Europe and the Muslim nations, and how long can they stay that way? Are they going to have to pick a side? Is it going to come to that?
Historically, they have been the dominant power in the region. After World War One, they stopped being it. Right now, they're surrounded in a sea of chaos. To their south is Syria and Iraq, and everything is going on there. To their north is Ukraine. To the northwest are the Balkans, which are always a mystery. It doesn't want to get involved. It doesn't want to intervene. The problem is it has no choice. History frequently isn't made by countries, you know, scheming great coups. They just wander into accidents. American history is kind of like that. And the Turks are going to become, in the next 20, 30 years, the dominant force in the region because there's no one else, and they can't live with all of their borders in chaos.
How are individual nation states within Europe changing the countries outside Europe with which they are allied?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. But, I mean, look, the most important thing that Europe did when you finally stand back in 1,000 is it created the United States. And the United States is not a European country, and Europeans don't understand that. They keep thinking we should be. The history of the world has shifted in the sense that where Europe used to always be a global entity, for the first time in 500 years, no European nation is. Only the United States is. We don't yet know what to do about it. We don't know how to think about it. We don't really want it. We wish to give it away. But we're almost 25% of the world's economy. We control all the oceans of the sea, oceans of the world. We are this enormous power. The Europeans are constantly drawing us back in. We don't want to be there. We are constantly drawn in. For the past 100 years, we've been drawn into Europe. First World War, Second World War, in the Cold War, and now again in the Russian involvement in Ukraine. So there are these two entities, Europe, a continent that has gone through catastrophe between 1914 and 1945, the United States, which emerges as its heir and is not quite sure what to do, and whatever happens in Europe draws us in. So this is one of the real – how it affects countries. It affects the United States immediately, because when a European crisis comes, apart from our tendency to involve ourselves in everything that happens, a European crisis is the one thing that for an entire century we've been involved in. So their mistakes, their conflicts almost inevitably involve us for good reason. Only Europe, and particularly only Germany allied with Russia, can challenge the United States. Only that has the capital, the technology, the manpower, the natural resources to come close to American power. And for 100 years, First World War, Second World War, Cold War, we have done everything possible with as little resources as necessary to stop Russia and Germany from amalgamating by war, by treaty, or by anything else. That's what the Cold War was entirely about. So I think when we think about how this affects the world, you expect to say, well, it affects the Middle East or it affects North Africa. It affects the United States more than anyone else because it drives us in directions we don't want to go. We've already placed a battalion of paratroopers in Ukraine. We have promised to preposition armor and artillery in the Baltics and Poland and Romania and Bulgaria. We have advisors all over the place. We are now deeply involved in this Ukrainian affair. So when Europe catches cold, the United States comes with the Kleenex. And that's the danger, that there'll be enough of a cold in Europe that we will have to get involved again.
As you look ahead to the potential flashpoints in Europe, are there some that will be, relatively speaking, easier for us to, if not ignore, remain relatively neutral on, and are there some that absolutely would demand us picking a side?
Well, some simply won't come to light. I mean, I can't imagine the Rhineland and the French-German border coming to life. I mean, that's just beyond imagination. Maybe I'm wrong. So there are many that we won't get involved in. I mean, if the Hungarians and the Romanians get into a battle over Transylvania, I would assume we won't get involved in. We get involved when major hegemons are there. Germany in World War I and World War II, the Soviet Union in the Cold War. I don't know that Russia is going to be a major hegemon. I mean, there's many weaknesses there. But even the sense of it beginning to emerge triggers American responses of what's going to get involved. So there are lots of things we won't get involved in. We're not getting involved in this financial crisis. There's nothing we can do. That's their problem. But when the consequences create the possibility of an amalgamation of European power, that's when we get involved.
I want to go back to something you said about Vladimir Putin's relative disappearance from the public eye for some time. You said you thought that looked like some kind of internal power struggle. Other people have said perhaps there was a health issue that they didn't want to reveal to the public. What makes you think that there's something going on in the Kremlin that might challenge Putin's authority?
Putin is in deep trouble over the economy. Putin has problems over Ukraine. These are all things that he has to deal with. his people and he perfectly well know that when you cancel signings of treaties and meetings with foreign presidents,
it's going to raise an eyebrow.
It's going to raise an eyebrow. At this time, the last thing you want to do is raise eyebrows. So as the events wore on, and wore on for 10 days, certainly at some point somebody could have said, you know, I know you have a cold or whatever. Show up on a TV show and talk. I know that you're on vacation with your family. You know, do it. It is inconceivable to me, given the political realities that he's living in, that he would let this crisis drag on this far only to show up and say nothing was wrong, because he's left the impression that there was some sort of political struggle. Things happened. A man called Surkov, who was very close to him, went to Hong Kong with his family. So when you look at all those things, it's very hard to imagine that he did this voluntarily. There was something going on. I don't know what it was, but he's not a fool. He's a very good politician, and he's got very good advisors, and it's not conceivable that he would have let this crisis get out of hand like that.
If there's some kind of change of leadership, you know, there's the devil you know and the devil you don't know. Would the interest of the United States be better served by anyone other than Putin?
Well, if the interest of the United States is to have a, as I like to put it, a Wisconsin Democrat in charge, this isn't going to happen. The people who are stronger potentially than Putin, and he's still very strong, maybe to his right or to his left or however you want to call it, more extreme. There's a faction called the Siloviki who are ultra-nationalists and ultra-national security people. And they feel that he was very soft and incompetent on Ukraine. And that's one faction that may emerge. But the idea that Putin's fall is going to give us the present of a Yeltsin, you know, a liberal incompetent that we don't have to worry about, that's unlikely to happen at this time. The greatest danger, of course, is that Moscow is no longer able to govern Russia. The way Russia works is Moscow collects the money for oil. It distributes it to the states, to the provinces, and it distributes it to the cities and towns. That plus the secret police holds it together. Secret police are not doing well. They're very much in business. They have other things to worry about. Well, if you get to the point where the money doesn't flow, what holds Russia together? And then there's a simple question, what happens to the nuclear weapons?
I hate to leave it there. George Friedman is chairman and founder of the private intelligence company Stratfor and author of the new book Flashpoints, The Emerging Crisis in Europe. He's in town to speak this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. George, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.